kept pace with my heartbeat. I felt a desperate need to recover my strength, but even sitting still was demanding more than I had to give. I wanted to topple over onto the floor and surrender to sleep. I tried to order my thoughts. You were so desperate to regain your sight. I didn't want to take that hope from you. My plan was that once you were strong enough, the coterie would try to heal you, if you would let them. My fear was that if I told you I couldn't heal you without losing my sight, you'd lose all hope. The last piece of the truth was angular and sharp-edged in my mouth. And I feared you would think me selfish that I did not heal you. I let my head lower onto my folded arms. The fool said something. I didn't hear that.
You weren't meant to,
he replied in a low voice. Then he admitted,
I called you a clodpole.
Oh, I could barely keep my eyes open. He asked a cautious question.
After you'd taken on my hurts, did they heal?
Yes, mostly, but very slowly. My back still bore the pinkish dimples in echo of the ulcers that had been on his back. Or so it seemed to me. You know how my body has been since that runaway healing the coterie did on me years ago. I scarcely age, and injuries heal overnight, leaving me exhausted. But they healed, fool. Once I knew what was happening, I was more careful. When I worked on the bones around your eyes, I kept strict control. I halted. It was a terrifying offer to make, but in our sort of friendship it had to be made. I could try to heal your eyes, give you sight, lose mine, and see if my body could restore mine. It would take time, and I am not sure this is the best place for us to make such an attempt. Perhaps in Bingtown, after we've sent the others home, we could take rooms somewhere and make the attempt.
No, don't be stupid.
His tone forbade any response. In his long silence, sleep crept up on me, seeping into every part of my body. It was that engulfing demand the body makes, one that knows no refusal.
Fitz, Fitz, look at me. What do you see?
I prized my eyelids open and looked at him. I thought I knew what he needed to hear.
I see my friend. My oldest, dearest friend, no matter what guise you wear. And you see me clearly?
Something in his voice made me lift my head. I blinked blearily and stared at him. After a time, he swam into focus.
Yes.
He let out his pent breath.
Good. Because when I touched you, I felt something happen, something more than I expected. I reached for you to call you back, for I feared you were vanishing into the skill current. But when I touched you, it wasn't as if I touched someone else. It was like folding my hands together, as if your blood suddenly ran through my veins. Fitz, I can see the shape of you, there in your chair. I fear I may have taken something from you.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I closed my eyes, too weary for surprise, too exhausted for fear. I thought of that other day, long ago, when I had drawn him back from death and pushed him into his own body again. In that moment, as I had left the body I had repaired for him, as we had passed each other before resuming our own flesh again, I'd felt the same. A sense of oneness, of completion. I recalled it, but was too weary to put it into words. I put my head down on the table and slept. I floated. I had been part of something immense, but now I was torn loose. broken away from the great purpose that had used me as a conduit, useless again. Voices blowing in the distance. I used to have nightmares about him. Once, I wet my bed. A boy gave a half laugh. Him? Why? Because of the first time I met him. I was just a child, really. A child given what seemed like a harmless task. To leave a gift for a baby. He cleared his throat. He caught me in B's room. Cornered me, like a rat. He must have known I was coming, though I can't guess how. He was suddenly there with a knife at my throat. Breathless silence.
Then what?
He forced me to strip down to my skin. I know now that he was intent on completely disarming me. He took everything I'd carried. Little knives, poison, wax to copy keys. All the things I'd been so proud to have, all the little tools for what my father wanted me to become. He took them. I stood naked and shivering while he stared at me, deciding what to do with me.
You thought he'd kill you? Tom Badgerlock?
I knew who he was. Rosemary had told me, and she told me that he was far more dangerous than I could imagine, in more ways. Witted. And that there had always been rumors that he had appetites.
I don't understand.
A pause. That he might desire boys as much as he liked women.
A dead silence. Then a lad laughed.
Him? Not him. There was only one for him. Lady Molly. It was always a joke among the servants at Withywood's.
He laughed again and then gasped.
Knock twice. The kitchen maids would giggle. And then wait and knock again. Never go in until one of them invites you. You never know where they will be going at each other. The men of the estate were proud of him. That old stud hasn't lost his fire, they'd say. In his study. In the gardens. Out in the orchards.
The orchard. A summer day. Her son's gone off to seek their fortunes. We'd walked among the trees, looking at the swelling apples, speaking of the harvest to come. Molly, her hands sweet with the wild blossoms she'd gathered. I'd paused to tuck a sprig of baby's breath into her hair. She had turned her face up to me, smiling. The long kiss had turned into something more.
When Lady Shun first came to Withywood's, one of the new housemaids said he'd gone off to find himself a willing woman. Cook Nutmeg told me of it. She told that housemaid. Not him. It was only Lady Molly, and never anyone else for him. He can't even see another woman. Then she told Revel what the housemaid had said. Revel called her into his study. He's not Lord Grab and Pinch. He's Holder Badgerlock. We won't have gossip here. And then he told her to pack her things. So Cook Nutmeg told us.
Molly had smelled like summer. Her flowers had scattered on the ground as I pulled her down to me. The deep orchard grass was a flimsy wall around us. Clothing pushed aside, a stubborn buckle on my belt, and then she was astride me, clutching my shoulders, leaning hard on her hands as she pinned me down. Leaning down, her breasts free of her blouse, putting her mouth on mine. The sun warmed her bare skin to my touch. Molly. Molly.
And now, do you still fear him?
The boy asked. The man was slow to reply.
He is to be feared. Make no mistake in that, Purr. Fitz is a dangerous man. But I'm not here because I have a rightful caution of him. I'm here to do my father's bidding. He tasked me to watch over him, to keep him safe from himself, to bring him home when all is done, if I can.
That won't be easy.
The boy said reluctantly.
I heard Foxglove talking to Riddle after that battle in the forest. She said he has a mind to hurt himself, to end himself, since his wife is dead and his child gone.
It won't be easy, the man conceded with a sigh. It won't be easy. I dreamed. It was not a pleasant dream. I was not a fly, but I was caught in a web.
It was a web of a peculiar sort, not of sticky threads, but of defined channels that I had to follow, as if they were deep footpaths cut through an impenetrable forest of fog-enshrouded trees. And so I moved, not willingly, but unable to do otherwise. I could not see where my trail led, but there was no other. Once I looked behind me, but the track I had followed had vanished. I could only go on. She spoke to me.
You interfered with what is mine. I am surprised, human. Are you too stupid to fear provoking dragons?
Dragons don't bother with introductions. The fog blew slowly away, and I was in a place where rounded grey stones, scabbed with lichen, humped out of a grassy sward. The wind was blowing as if it had never begun and would never stop. I was alone. I tried to be small and kept silent. Her thoughts still found me.
The child was mine to shape. You had no right.
Huddling small had not worked. I tried to keep my thoughts calm, but I fervently wished that Nettle were here with me in this dreamscape. She had withstood the full onslaught of the dragon Tintaglia when she was still new to the skill. I reached for my daughter, but the dragon boxed me as if I were a frog captured in a boy's calloused hands. I was in her control and alone. I hid my fear of her deep inside my chest. I did not know which dragon this was, and I knew better than to ask. A dragon guards its name lest others acquire power over it.
It's only a dream.
Scarcely applies to what a dragon can do to one's sleeping mind. I needed to wake up, but she pinned me as a hawk's talons would pin a struggling hare. I felt the cold and stony land beneath me, felt the icy wind ripping warmth from my body, and still I saw nothing of her. Perhaps logic might reach her. My intent was never to interfere, but only to make the small changes that would let the children live.
The child was mine.
Do you prefer a dead child to a live one?
Mine is mine, not yours.
The logic of a three-year-old. The pressure on my chest increased, and a translucent shape coalesced above me. She shimmered blue and silver. I recognized which child she claimed by the markings she shared with the child's mother. The mother had been the woman who claimed to work with silver. Timara, the winged and clawed elderling. This dragon claimed the girl child who had been fearless in choosing the changes she would have. A child that was only marginally human. She had not hesitated to choose dragon feet over human ones so that she might leap higher and grip limbs better when she climbed. A brave and intelligent child.
That she is.
I sensed a grudging pride. I had not meant to share the thought, but perhaps flattering the child or the dragon might win me a reprieve. The pressure of the dragon's foot on my chest had gone past painful, to the sensation of ribs flexed as far as they could bend. If she cracked my ribs into stabbing pieces that punctured my lungs, would I die or wake up? Being aware that I was dreaming did not lessen the pain or the sense of imminent disaster.
Die in your dreams, wake up insane,
or so the old elderling saying went.
Your connections to this world are strong, little human. There is something about you, yet you are not dragon-touched by any dragon I know. How is that possible?
I don't know.
What is this thread I perceive in you, dragon and not dragon? Why have you come to Kelsingrar? What brought you to the dragon's city?
Revenge, I gasped. I could feel my ribs beginning to give way. The pain was astonishing. Surely if I were asleep, this pain would wake me. So this was real. Somehow this was real. And if it were real, I would have a knife at my belt. And if it were real, I wouldn't die like a pinned hare. My right arm was caught under the dragon's talon, but my left was free. I reached, groped, and found it, drew it and stabbed with all my remaining strength, only to have it clash against the heavy scaling of the dragon's foot. My blade skated and turned aside, as if I had tried to stab a stone. She did not even flinch.
You seek revenge on dragons? For what?
My arm fell lifelessly away. I did not even feel my fingers lose their grip on the knife. Pain and lack of air were emptying me of will. I did not utter the words, for I had no air left. I thought the matter.
Not revenge on dragons. On the servants. I'm going to Clary's to kill all the servants. They hurt my friend and destroyed my child.
Clary's?
Dread. A dragon could feel dread. Amazing. Even more surprising, it seemed to be dread of the unknown.
A city of bones and white stones far south of here, on an island. A city of pale folk who believe they know all the futures and which one is best to choose.
The servants!
She began to fade from my dream.
I remember something very bad.
Suddenly I was unimportant to her. As her attention left me, I could breathe again, and I floated in a dark grey world, either dead or alone in my sleep. No, I didn't want to sleep and be vulnerable to her. I struggled toward wakefulness, trying to recall where my body truly was. I opened my eyes to deep night and blinked sticky eyes. A mild wind was blowing across the hills. I could see the trees swaying in it. In the distance, I saw snow-topped mountains. The moon was big and round, and the ivory of old bones. Game would be moving. Why had I been sleeping so soundly? My head felt as if it was stuffed full of wool. I lifted my face and snuffed the air. I felt no breeze and smelled no forest, only myself. Sweat. The smell of an occupied room. The bed was too soft. I tried to sit up. Nearby, clothing rustled, and someone set strong hands on my shoulders. Go slow. Let's start with water. The night sky was a cheat, and I'd never hunt like that again.
Don't touch me skin to skin, I reminded Lant.
His hands went away, and I struggled into a sitting position. I swung my legs over the edge of the bed. The room spun three times and settled. All was dim and twilight around me.
Take this, he said,
and a cool container was pushed gently into my hands. I smelled it. Water. I drank until it was gone. He took it away and came back with more. I drained it again. That's enough for now, I think.
What happened?
He sat down beside me on the edge of the bed. I looked at him carefully and was grateful I could see him.
What do you recall?
He asked me after a long silence.
I was healing elderling children.
You touched children. One after another. Not that many, six, I think. They all grew better, and with every healed child, the wonder of the Kelsingar elderlings grew, and you became stranger. I have no skill, Fitz, yet even I felt as if you were the eye of a storm of magic that flowed toward you and then blew all around us. And when there were no more children, other people began to push forward. Not just the elderlings, but Rainwild folk. I'd never seen people so malformed. Some had scales, and some had dangling growths along their jaws. Some had claws or dragon nostrils, but not in a lovely way, not like the elderlings do. They were like diseased trees, and full of sudden hope. They began to push toward you, asking you to mend them. Your eyes were blank and you didn't answer. You just began to touch them, and they collapsed. Their bodies changed, but almost immediately you went pale and began to shake. Yet still you wouldn't stop, and still they came on, pushing and begging. Lady Amber cried out to you and shook you, and still you stared, and still distorted people pushed toward you. Then Amber pulled off her glove and clutched your wrist and dragged you back from them. My recollection was like a tapestry unfurling, Lant was blessedly silent as I pieced my life back together.
And since then? Is all well?
I recalled the pushing and the shouting crowd.
Were any of you hurt? Where are the others?
No one was hurt seriously, scratches and bruises.
He gave a disbelieving snort.
And only Spark still bears those marks. When you touched me and Purr, all our hurts were healed. I have not felt this healthy since before I was beaten that night in Buckkeep Town.
I'm sorry. He stared at me.
You're sorry for healing me?
For doing it so abruptly, without warning. The skill, I could not control it.
He stared past me. It felt peculiar, as if I'd been dunked in an ice-cold river and then fished out right away, as dry and warm as I'd been.
His voice trailed away as he recalled it. Where are they now, Amber and Spark and Purr? Was there danger? Had I slept while they were threatened?
Probably sleeping still. I took this watch.
Watch? How long have I been here? He gave a small sigh.
This is the second night. Well, perhaps I should say the morning of the third day. It's nearly dawn.
I think I fell asleep at the table.
You did. We moved you to the bed. I feared for you, but Amber said to let you sleep and not to call in a healer. I think she worried what might happen if a healer touched your skin. She bade us all be very careful not to touch you.
I answered his unspoken question. I think I have control of my skill again. I was still for a moment, investigating the flow of the magic. It was strong here in the old city, but I once more felt it as something outside myself rather than a current flowing through me. I considered my walls and found them stronger than I had expected.
I gave you powdered elf bark,
Lant reminded me. That I recall. I turned to stare at him. I'm surprised you carry such a thing. He looked away from me.
You recall my father's early hopes for me, the training I had. I brought many small things on this journey.
For a time, we were both silent. Then I asked him, what of General Rapskull? What is the current feeling toward us here in Kelsingra?
Lant licked his lips. Great respect founded on fear, I think. Amber has counseled us to caution. We have been eating in our rooms and mingling little. None of us has seen General Rapskull. But there has been one note from him, and three visits from one of his soldiers, an elderling named Case. He was respectful but insistent that General Rapskull needed a private meeting with you. We've turned him away because you were still resting, but none of us feels it would be safe for you to meet with him alone. The General seems peculiar.
I nodded silently, but quietly resolved that a private meeting might eventually be needed, if I were to dispel whatever threat the General presented to Amber. After such a meeting, he just might fall deathly ill if he continued to pursue his vendetta.
The elderlings have respected our wish for solitude, Lant continued. I suspect the King and Queen have sheltered us from curiosity and requests. Mostly we've encountered the serving folk, and they seem to feel kindly toward us.
He added awkwardly,
some are touched by the Rainwilds in unpleasant ways. I fear that some may seek healing from you, despite the King's order that you be left in peace. We did not want to leave you alone because we did not want the elderlings to find you unguarded. At first, then we feared you might be dying.
As if startled by his own words, he suddenly sat up straight and said,
I should let the others know you were awake. Do you want food?
No. Yes. I didn't want it, but I knew I needed it. I had not been dying, but I had not been living, either. My body felt like soiled clothing, stiff with dirt and smelly with sweat. I rubbed my face, definitely a beard now. My eyes were gummy, my tongue and teeth coated.
I'll see to it, then.
He left. The room was lightening around me, mimicking dawn. The nightscape on the wall was fading.
I dragged off the elderling robe I wore as I went to the pool. As soon as I knelt by the waterspout, it began to release steaming water. I was soaking in hot water when Amber entered. Perseverance was with her, but she walked beside him, not relying on him to guide her as they came directly to the pool's edge. I answered the basic questions before they could be asked. I'm awake. Nothing hurts. I'm starting to get hungry. I have my skill under control, I think. Please avoid touching me until I'm sure.
How are you truly?
Amber asked me. I liked that her eyes settled on me even as I wondered if my vision was diminished at all. If the fool had gained a small amount of vision, had I lost some of mine? I had not noticed a difference. Yet. I'm awake, still tired but not sleepy.
You slept a long time. We feared for you.
Amber sounded hurt, as if my being unconscious had bruised her feelings. The hot water had loosened my muscles. My body was starting to feel more familiar, as if I might belong in it. I ducked my head one more time and scrubbed my eyes clear. I waded out of the water, still some aches. 60 was not 30, regardless of how I might appear. Perseverance left Amber's side to bring me a drying cloth and then a robe. I spoke as I wiped water from my legs. What is the mood of the city? Did I harm anyone? Amber spoke.
Apparently not, at least not in a permanent way. The children you touched all seemed to be faring better now than before you touched them. The Rainwilders you touched have sent you notes of thanks, and of course, please that you help others. At least 3 have left notes under the door begging you to help them with their changes. Exposure to dragons or even areas where dragons were long present seems to trigger their afflictions, and those deliberately changed by dragons fare much better than those who simply are born with changes or acquire them as they grow. Those changes are often deadly to children, and life-shortening for all.
5 notes now, Perseverance said quietly. 2 more were outside the door when we came. I shook my head. I dare not try to help anyone. Even with the elf bark Lant gave me, I can feel the skill current sweeping past me like a riptide. I won't venture into that again. I poked my head out of the neck hole of the green elderling robe. The skin on my arms was still damp, but I wrestled my hands through the sleeves, shrugged my shoulders, and felt the garment settle itself around me. Elderling magic? Was there silver in the fabric of this robe, reminding it that it was a garment? The elderlings had mixed skill into their roads so that they always recalled they were roads. Moss and grass never consumed them. Was there a difference between the skill and the magic the elderlings had used to create this marvelous city? How did the magics intersect? There was too much I didn't know, and I was glad that Lant had dosed me and rescued me from any further experiments. I want to leave here as soon as we can. I hadn't thought about saying the words, they just came out of my mouth. I walked as I spoke, and Purr and Amber followed me through the bedroom and into the entry chamber. Lant was there.
I agree, he said instantly. Unskilled as I am, still the whispering of the city reaches me stronger with every passing day. I need to be away from here. We should be gone before the goodwill of the elderlings fades. General Rapscal may be able to sway people against us, or folk may begin to resent that you refuse to heal them.
Indeed, I think that very wise, that we cannot be too hasty. Even if there was a ship heading downriver, we would still have to be sure we bid farewell to Kelsingra in a way that ruffles no feathers.
Amber's voice was pensive.
We have a long journey through their territories, and the dragon traders have deep ties with the Rainwild traders. They in turn have deep family ties with Bingtown and the Bingtown traders. We must travel by river from here to Treehog in the Rainwilds. From there, our safest transport would be on one of the live ships that move on the river. We must journey at least as far as Bingtown, and there find a vessel that will take us through the Pirate Isles and to Jamalia.
so the goodwill of the Dragon Keepers may bear us far, at least as far as Bingtown, and perhaps beyond.
He paused, then added,
For we must journey beyond Jamalia, and beyond the Spice Isles.
And then off the edge of any proven chart I've ever seen.
Strange waters to you will be home ports to others. We will find our way there. I found my way to Buck many years ago. I can find my way back to my homeland again.
His words were little comfort to me. I was already tired just from standing. What had I done to myself? I sat down in one of the chairs, and it welcomed me. I had expected to travel alone and light, working my passage for some of it. I've made no plans for this type of journey, no provisions for taking anyone with me. Soft chimes sounded and the door opened. A manservant wheeled a small table into the room. Covered dishes, a stack of plates. Clearly a meal for all of us. Spark slipped in through the open door. She was dressed and groomed, but her eyes told me she had only recently left sleep behind. Lant thanked the serving man. Our silence held until the door had closed behind him. Spark began to uncover the dishes on the tray, while Perseverance put out the plates.
There's a scroll tube here, a heavy one with a funny crest on it. A chicken wearing a crown.
The crowned rooster is the Cuprous family crest,
Amber told us. A shiver went up my back. That's different from a rooster crown?
It is, though I have wondered if they have some ancient relationship.
What's a rooster crown?
Spark asked.
Open the letter and read it, please,
Amber said, fending off her question. Perseverance passed it to Spark, who handed it to Lant.
It's addressed to the 6 Duchy's emissaries, so I suppose that means all of us.
Lant broke the wax seal and tugged out a page of excellent paper. His eyes skimmed down it.
Rumors of your waking have dashed from the kitchen to the throne room. We are invited to dine tonight with the Kelsengrad Dragon Keepers, if Prince Fitzchivalry's health permits.
He lifted his eyes to mine.
The Keepers, I have learned, are the original Rainwilders who set out with the dragons to find Kelsengrad, or at least a habitable area for dragons. There were not many of them, less than 20, I believe. Others have come to live here, of course. Rainwilders seeking a better life, former slaves and other folk. Some of the Keepers have taken wives from among the newcomers. Their ambassadors to King Dutiful presented themselves as coming from a populous and prosperous city. But what I've seen here and heard from the serving folk tells me a different story.
He mused.
They've had only moderate luck at building their population to a level that can sustain the city, even on a village level. The Rainwild folk find that they change faster when they live here, and seldom in good ways. As you have seen, the children born in Kelsengrad are not many, and the changes that mark them are not always good ones.
An excellent report,
Spark said in a fair imitation of Shade's voice. Perseverance snorted into his hands.
Truly,
Amber agreed, and the color rose in Lant's cheeks.
He trained you well, I said.
Why do you think they convene and invite us to dine with them?
To thank you?
Perseverance seemed incredulous. I would not have thought of that.
It will be the preliminary to bargaining with us. It's the trade away.
Amber sighed.
We know what we need from them. Fresh supplies and passage as far south as we can get. The question is, what will they ask of us in return?
Chapter 3 In the Mountains.
This was a very short dream. A chalk-faced man, dressed in robes of green, trimmed with gold, walked on a beach. A grotesque creature hunched on a grassy outcrop above the beach and watched him, but the man paid it no mind. He was carrying fine chains, as if to be worn as jewelry, but much stronger. He carried them in loops on his arm. He came to a place where the sand was shaking and bulging. He watched it, smiling. Snakes began to come out of the earth. They were large snakes, as long as my arm.
They were wet, and their skins were bright shades of blue and red and green and yellow. The man put a looped chain around the head of a blue one, and the chain became a noose. He lifted the snake clear of the ground. It thrashed, but it could not get away, even though it opened wide its mouth and showed white teeth, very pointed. The pale man caught another snake in his snare, a yellow one. Next, he tried to catch a red one, but it shook free of him and slithered away very fast toward the sea.
"I will have you!"
the man shouted, and he chased the snake and stepped on the end of its tail, trapping it near the wave's edge. He held the leashes of his two captive snakes in one hand, and in the other he shook out a fresh snare for the red snake. He thought she would turn and dart her head at him, and he would loop the chain around her neck. But it was a dragon who turned on him, for he was treading on a dragon's tail.
"No," she said to him very loudly, "but I will have you."
The picture I have painted for this dream is not very good, for my father's red ink does not gleam and glisten as the snake did. Dream Journal of B. Farcia. I slept cold and woke to the toe of Dwalia's shoe nudging my sore belly.
"What have you been doing?"
she demanded of me, and then snarled over her shoulder.
"Aleria, you were supposed to be watching her. Look at this. She's been chewing at her bonds."
Aleria came at a stumbling trot, her fur coat slung around her shoulders, her pale hair a tangle around her bleary-eyed face.
"I was up almost all night. I asked Repin to watch her."
Dwalia spun away from me. I tried to sit up. My bound hands were cold and nearly numb. My whole body was stiff with various bruises and cuts. I fell over and tried to roll away from her, but I didn't get far. I heard a slap and then a wordless yelp.
"No excuses,"
Dwalia snarled. I heard her stalk away. I tried to stagger to my feet, but Aleria was swifter. She put a knee in my back to keep me down. I twisted toward her to bite. She put one hand on the back of my head and pushed my face down on the paving stone.
"Give me a reason to slam your teeth into that,"
she invited me. I didn't.
"Don't hurt my brother,"
Vindalaya wailed.
"Don't hurt my brother,"
Dwalia mocked him in a shrill whine.
"Be silent."
The last word she spoke with a grunt, and I heard Vindalaya yelp. Aleria pulled at my tunic hem, then sawed strips from it with her belt knife. She cursed in a guttural voice as she worked. I could feel her fury. Now was not a good time to challenge her. She rolled me over roughly, and I saw the print of Dwalia's hand on her face, livid red against her pale skin.
"Bitch,"
she snapped, and I did not know if she meant me or Dwalia. She seized my stiff hands and jerked them roughly toward her. She brutally sawed at the sodden rags with her dull knife. I pulled my wrists as far apart as I could, hoping she would not cut me. "This time I tie them behind your back," she promised through gritted teeth. I heard footsteps crunching through leaves and twigs, and Repin came to join Aleria.
"I'm sorry,"
she said quietly. "My hand hurts so much."
"It's fine,"
Aleria said in a tone that said it was not.
"She's so unfair," Repin said. "So cruel to us. We are supposed to be her advisors, and she treats us like servants, and tells us nothing, not a word of what she plans now that she has dragged us to this horrid place. This is not what Symph intended for us."
Aleria relented in her sulk. "There's a road over there. I think we should follow it. It makes no sense to stay here."
"Perhaps it goes to a village,"
Repin offered hopefully. She added in a softer voice, "I need a healer. My whole arm throbs."
"All of you, go fetch wood,"
Dwalia shouted from her seat by the dwindling fire. Vindalaya looked up with a woeful face. I saw Repin and Alaria exchange rebellious glances.
"I said all of you!"
Dwalia shrieked.
Vindaliya came to his feet and stood uncertainly. Dwalia stood up, a much folded paper in her hand. She looked at it angrily, gripped it so tightly that I knew it was the source of her ire.
"That liar!" she growled. "I should have known. I should not have trusted a word that we wrung from Prilkop."
Abruptly she slapped Vindaliya with her paper.
"Go! Get wood! We will be here another night at least. Alaria, Repin, take Bea with you. Watch her. We need firewood. Lots of it. You, Chael Sedion, go hunt for some food for us."
Kerf did not even turn his head. He was perched on a low stone wall and looking across the square at nothing. Nothing until I eased my walls down and saw tumblers, clad all in black and white, performing for a crowd of tall folk with oddly coloured hair. Sounds of a busy market day filled my ears. I squeezed my eyes shut, firmed my walls, and opened my eyes to the long deserted plaza. For that was what it was. Once, this open space in the forest had been a lively market square, a crossroads, where traders met to exchange wares and elderlings gathered for amusement and shopping. "Come on," Alaria snapped at me. I got slowly to my feet. If I walked hunched over, my belly did not hurt so badly. Eyes on the ground, I followed them as they crossed the ancient paving stones. I saw bear scat among the sparse forest debris, and then a glove. I slowed my pace. Another lady's glove, this one of soft yellow kid, then some sodden canvas. Something red and knitted peeped out from beneath it. Slowly and carefully, I stooped and tugged out a red woolen shawl. It was as damp and smelly as the hat I'd found, but just as welcome.
"What do you have there?"
Dwalia demanded, and I flinched. I hadn't heard her come up behind me. "Just a rag," I said, my words blurred by my swollen mouth. "There's a lot of rubbish over here," Repin observed. "Which shows that people use this road," Alaria added. She looked toward Dwalia as she said, "If we followed it, we might soon come to a village, and a healer for Repin." "There's bear scat, too," I contributed, "and it's fresher than the rubbish." That last part was true. The excrement was on top of some of the canvas and unmelted by rain.
"Ew!"
Alaria had been tugging at a corner of some canvas. She dropped it and sprang back.
"What's that?"
Dwalia exclaimed and pushed her aside. She squatted down and peeled the canvas back from the wet stones to expose something white and cylindrical.
"A bone? Umph!"
she exclaimed in satisfaction. We all watched as she unscrewed a small plug from the end and coaxed out a coiled piece of parchment.
"What is it?"
Alaria asked.
"Go get wood,"
Dwalia snapped and took her treasure back to the fireside.
"Move, Bea,"
Alaria commanded me. I hastily wrapped my shawl around my shoulders and followed them. For the rest of the morning they broke sticks from storm-fallen branches and piled them in my arms for me to carry back to the campsite. Dwalia remained crouched by the fire, brow furrowed over the little scroll she'd found.
"I'm going to die here," Repin announced. She was huddled under her coat and mine, her bitten arm cradled in her lap.
"Don't be dramatic,"
Dwalia snapped at her and went back to studying her papers, squinting as the light faded from the day. It had been 2 days since I'd bitten Repin, and here we still were. Dwalia had forbidden Alaria from exploring any farther down the old roads, and had slapped Repin for asking what we would do next. Since she had found the bone cylinder and discovered the parchment inside it, all she had done was sit by the fire and compare it with her crumpled paper. She scowled and squinted as her gaze moved from one to the other. I stared at Repin across the fire. The sun was going down, and the cold was creeping back. The small amount of warmth the stones of the old plaza had captured would soon flee. Repin probably felt colder because of her fever. I kept my mouth flat. She was right. She would die. Not quickly, but she would die. Wolf Father had told me, and when I let him guide my senses, I could smell the infection in her sweat.
Next time, for a faster kill, you must find and bite a place where the blood leaps forth in gushes. But for a first kill, you did well, even if this is meat you cannot eat. I didn't know my bite could kill her. No regrets.
Wolf Father chided me.
There is no going back to do a thing or not do a thing. There is only today. Today you must resolve to live. Each time you are given a choice, you must do the thing that will keep you alive and unhurt. Regrets are useless. If you had not made her fear you, she would have done you many more hurts, and the others would have joined in. They are a pack, and they will follow their leader. You made the bitch fear you, and the others know that. What she fears, they will fear.
So I kept my face set and showed no remorse, though I did suspect that the prescription against eating humans had not been made by someone as hungry as I was. In the 2 days that had passed since we'd arrived, I'd eaten twice, if a thin soup of some bird Alaria had killed with a thrown stone and 2 handfuls of meal cooked in a full pot of water could be counted as food. The others had eaten better than I had. I had wanted to be too proud to eat the little they offered me, but Wolffather said that was a poor choice.
Eat to live, he had told me. Be proud of staying alive.
And so I tried. I ate what I was given, spoke little, and listened much. By day, they untied my hands and hobbled my ankles so I could help with the endless task of scavenging for firewood. My new bonds had been made from strips torn from my tunic. I dared not chew them again, lest they tear away even more of my clothing. They watched me closely. If I strayed at all from Alaria's side, Dwalia would hit me with a stick. Every night she bound my wrists to my tied ankles and tethered them to her wrist. If I shifted in my sleep, she kicked me. Hard. And with every kick, Wolffather would snarl.
Kill her. As soon as possible. You and I are the only ones left,
Repin whispered that night to Alaria after Dwalia slept.
I am here,
Vindalaya reminded them.
Of the true Lurix,
Repin clarified disdainfully.
You are no scholar of the Dream Skull. Stop spying on us.
She lowered her voice as if to exclude Vindalaya.
Remember when Simph herself said we were chosen as the best to help Dwalia discern the path? But from the beginning, she ignored our advice. We both know that girl has no value.
She sighed.
I fear we have strayed very far from the way.
Alaria sounded uncertain as she said,
But B did have the fever and the skin change. That must mean something. Only that she has some white heritage, not that she can dream. Certainly not that she is this unexpected son that Dwalia claimed we would find.
Repin dropped her voice to a whisper.
You know she is not. Even Dwalia no longer credits that. Alaria, we must protect each other. No one else will. When Simph and Dwalia proposed this mission, Capra and Coltrie both insisted that we had already endured the unexpected son, that he was the one who freed Icefire and put an end to Illistor. So Beloved told us when he came back to Clarys. He said that one of his catalysts, the noble assassin, was the unexpected son. Among his people, they called Illistor the Pale Woman, and she was defeated by the unexpected son. All know that. 3 of the 4 say that the dreams related to him are fulfilled, and those prophecies should be discarded now. Only Simph thought otherwise, and Dwalia.
I held my breath. They were speaking of my father. I knew from poring through his papers that the fool had said he was the unexpected son, but I had never grasped that in some far-off land he had been the fulfillment of a prophecy. Furtively, I edged closer. Repin dropped her voice.
Simph believed her only because Dwalia showered her with obscure references that said the unexpected son's victory would be absolute.
And it was not, because Beloved came back to us and was recaptured. And remember that Dwalia served Illistor for years and was infatuated with her. Dwalia always bragged that when Illistor returned, she would raise her to power. She barely breathed the next words. I think Dwalia only wants vengeance. You recall how she was about Beloved. She holds him responsible for Illistor's death. And you know whose home we stole Bea from? Fitz Chivalry's.
Alaria sat up in her blankets.
No! Yes! Fitz Chivalry Farcia!
Repin reached up to tug her back down.
Think back. Recall the name Beloved shouted when his foot was being crushed? The name of his true catalyst. He'd held that back, saying he'd had many. An assassin? A nine-fingered slave boy? A ship's captain? A spoiled girl? A noble bastard? Not true. His one real catalyst was Fitz Chivalry Farcia, and when I followed Dwalia into that house, in a room full of scrolls, she stopped still and stared and smiled, and there, on a mantelpiece, I saw a carving. One of the faces on it was Beloved's, as he looked before he was interrogated.
She nestled deeper into their bedding.
She wanted to take it, but just then Elik's men came in and began to push over shelves and throw things around. They took a sword from there, so we left. But that's who Bea is, the daughter of a catalyst.
They said the house belonged to Badgerlock, Tom Badgerlock. Bea said that was her father's name.
So, you are surprised that the biting little bitch lies? But she is a wight, too.
Alaria's whisper was soft. I strained to hear Repin's reply.
Yes, and think now how such a thing as that could come to be.
Her words were triumphantly scandalized, as if my very existence was shameful. Vindalaya is listening. Alaria cautioned her. She shifted, pulling the coat more closely around them.
I don't care about such things. I just want to go home. Back to Clary's. I want to sleep in a bed and have breakfast waiting for me when I wake. I wish I'd never been chosen for this. My hand hurts so badly I'd like to kill that brat.
Don't talk like that,
Vindalaya warned them.
You shouldn't talk at all. It's your fault, all of this,
Repin hissed at him.
Sneaking spy,
Alaria rebuked him, and they all fell silent. It was not the only time they whispered at night, though most of what they said made little sense to me. Repin complained of her bite, and they discussed the politics of Clary's, with names I did not know and fine points I could not understand. They promised to report all they had suffered when they returned home, and agreed that Dwalia would be punished. Twice they spoke of dreams about a destroyer whom Alaria claimed would bring screaming and foul fumes and death. In one, an acorn brought into a house suddenly grew into a tree of flames and swords. I recalled my own dream of the puppet with the acorn head and wondered if there was any connection. But I had also dreamed of a nut bobbing in a stream. I decided that my dreams were very confusing, almost as bad as Repin's, for she had dreamed just darkness. And a voice that announced,
"Comes the destroyer that you have made."
I gleaned what facts I could from their whispering. Some important people had not agreed about allowing Dwalia to go forth on her mission. When she persisted, they had relented, but only because Beloved had escaped. From my father's writings, Beloved was also the Fool. And Lord Golden, the Four, had warned Dwalia of what would befall her if she failed to produce results. She had promised to deliver to them the unexpected son, and I was all she had. Vindalaya was excluded from their discussions, but he so craved their attention that he had no pride. One night, as they whispered under their furs, he broke in excitedly to say,
"I had a dream too."
"You did not," Repin declared.
"I did."
He was as defiant as a child.
I dreamed that someone brought a small package into a room and no one wanted it. But then someone opened it and flames and smoke and loud noises came out and the room fell apart all around everyone.
You did not dream that. Repin exploded with disdain. You are such a liar. You heard me talking about that dream and just repeated what you heard.
I did not hear you say such a dream.
He was indignant. Alaria's voice was a low growl. You'd better not claim that dream with Dwalia, because I already told it to her. She will know you for what a liar you are and beat you with a stick.
I did dream that,
he whined.
Sometimes whites dream the same. You know that.
You are no white. You were born broken, you and your sister. You should have been drowned. I caught my breath at that and waited for Vindalaya to explode with fury. Instead, he fell silent. The cold wind blew and the only thing we truly shared was misery and dreams. Even as a small child, I'd had vivid dreams and instinctively known they were important and should be shared. At home, I'd recorded them in my journal. Since the servants had stolen me, my dreams had grown darker and more ominous. I had neither spoken of them nor written them down. The unuttered dreams were lodged inside me like a bone in my throat. With every additional dream, the driving compulsion to speak them aloud or write them down became stronger. The dream images were confusing. I held a torch and stood at a crossroads under a wasp nest. A scarred little girl held a baby, and Nettle smiled at her, although both Nettle and the girl were weeping. A man burned the porridge he was cooking, and wolves howled in anguish. An acorn was planted in gravel, and a tree of flames grew from it. The earth shook, and the black rain fell and fell and fell, making dragons choke and fall to the earth with torn wings. They were stupid dreams that made no sense, but the urgency I felt to share them was like the need to vomit. I put my finger on the cold stone and pretended to write and draw. The pressure eased. I tilted my head up and looked at distant stars. No clouds. It was going to be very cold tonight. I struggled to wrap my shawl more warmly around me, to no avail. A third day passed, and a fourth. Dwalia paced and muttered and studied her documents. My bruises began to fade, but I still ached all over. The swelling over my eye had gone down, but one of my back teeth still felt loose. The split flesh on my cheekbone was mostly closed over now. None of them cared.
Take me back through the stone,
Repin demanded on the fourth evening.
Perhaps they could save me if we returned to the six duchies. At least I could die in a bed instead of in the dirt.
Failures die in the dirt, Dwalia said without emotion.
Repin made a stricken sound and lay down on her side. She drew her legs up, treasuring her infected arm close. My disgust with Dwalia equaled my hatred in that moment. Alaria spoke quietly into the gathering dimness.
We can't stay here. Where will we go? Why can't we follow this old road? It must lead somewhere. Perhaps it goes to a town, with warm shelter and food.
Dwalia had been sitting by the fire, holding her hands out to the warmth. She suddenly folded her arms across her chest and glared at Alaria.
Are you asking questions?
Alaria looked down.
I was just wondering.
She dared to lift her head.
Were not we Lurics meant to advise you? Were not we sent to help you find the true path and make correct decisions?
Her voice rose in pitch.
Coltrane and Capra did not wish you to go. They only allowed this because Beloved had escaped. We were to hunt him down and kill him, and then perhaps capture the unexpected son if Beloved had led you to him. But you let the Farseer take Beloved away so we could ransack his home. All that killing. Now we are lost in a forest with the useless girl you stole. Does she dream? No. What good is she? I wonder why you have brought us all here to die. I wonder if the rumor was true that Beloved did not escape, but was released by you and Symph.
Dwalia shot to her feet and stood over Elaria.
I am a Lyngstra. You are a young and stupid Lurik. If you want to wonder anything, wonder why the fire is dying. Go get more wood.
Elaria hesitated as if she would argue. Then she rose stiffly and walked reluctantly into the gathering gloom under the great trees. Over the last few days, we had gathered all the close dry wood. She would have to range deeper into the forest to find more. I wondered if she would come back. Twice Wolffather had noted a faint but foul smell on the air.
Bear,
he had cautioned me. I had been frightened.
He does not want to approach so many humans near a fire. But if he changes his mind, let the others shriek and run. You cannot run fast or far, so lie very still and do not make a sound. It may be he will chase after the others.
But if he does not?
Lie still and don't make a sound.
I had not been reassured, and I hoped that Elaria would return and bring an armful of firewood with her.
You,
Twalia said suddenly,
go with her.
You already tied my feet for the night,
I pointed out to her,
and my hands.
I tried to sound sullen. If she cut me free to go for wood, I was almost certain I could slip away in the gloom.
Not you. I'm not having you run off in the dark to die in the forest. Repin, fetch wood.
Repin looked incredulous.
I can barely move this arm. I can't fetch wood.
Dwalia stared at her. I thought she might order her to her feet. Instead, she just pursed her mouth.
Useless, she said coldly, and then added, Vindalaya, fetch wood.
Vindalaya rose slowly. He kept his eyes cast down, but I could read his resentment in the set of his shoulders as he wandered off in the same direction that Elaria had gone. Dwalia went back to doing what she did every evening, studying the little scroll and the tattered paper. Earlier, she had spent hours circling the pillars at the edge of the plaza, her eyes going from the parchment she'd found to the runes and back again. Some of those markings I had seen in my father's papers in his study. Would she attempt another passage through the skill pillars? She had also made brief forays on the road in both directions, and had returned shaking her head and irritable. I could not decide which I feared more, that she would drag us into the skill pillar, or starve us here. Across the plaza, Kerf was engaged in a boot-stomping dance. If I allowed myself, I could hear the music and see the elderlings who danced all about him. Elaria returned with some frozen branches broken green from trees. They might burn, but would give little warmth. Vindalaya came behind her, carrying a broken piece of rotted log, more moss than wood. As they approached the fire, Kerf danced a foot-stamping jig around them.
Go away!
Elaria shouted at him, but he only grinned as he spun away to rejoin the festivities of the spectral elderlings. I did not like camping in the open ground of the plaza, but Dwalia thought the forest floor was dirty. But dirt was much better than the smooth black stone of the plaza that gibbered and whispered to me constantly. Awake, I could keep my walls tight, though I was weary of the effort that took. But at night, when exhaustion finally claimed me, I was vulnerable to the voices stored in the stone. Their marketplace came alive with smoking meat over fragrant fires, and jugglers flipping sparkling gems, and one pale songster who seemed to see me.
Be strong, be strong, go where you belong,
she sang to me, but her words more frightened than comforted me. In her eyes I saw her belief that I would do a terrible and wonderful thing, a thing only I could do. The Chalcedian abruptly dropped into place beside me. I jumped. My walls were so tight I had not been aware of his approach.
Danger,
Wolffather cautioned me. Kerf folded his legs and gave me a jaunty grin.
A fine night for the festival,
he said to me. Have you tried the smoked goat? Excellent. He pointed across the plaza at the darkening forest. From the vendor with the purple awning. Madness made him such a congenial fellow. His mention of food made my stomach clench. Excellent, I said quietly, and looked aside, thinking that agreeing might be the swiftest way to end the conversation. He nodded gravely and walked his haunches a bit closer to the fire, holding his grimy hands toward the warmth. Even mad, he had more sense than Repin. A rag torn from his shirt bandaged the finger I'd bitten. He opened the sturdy leather pouch at his belt and rummaged in it. Here, he said and thrust a stick at me. I lifted my bound hand to fend it off, and he pushed it into my fingers. I suddenly smelled meat. Jerky. The rush of hunger and the flood of saliva in my mouth shocked me. My hands shook as I lifted it to my mouth. It was dry and so hard I could not bite off a piece. I chewed and sucked on it, and found myself breathing hard as I tried to gnaw off a piece I could swallow.
I know what you did.
I clutched the stick of jerky harder, fearful he would take it from me. I said nothing. Dwalia had lifted her gaze from her papers and was scowling at us. I knew she would not try to take the jerky from me for fear of my teeth. He patted my shoulder.
You tried to save me. If I had let go when you bit me, I would have stayed there with beautiful Shun. I understand that now. You wanted me to stay behind, to protect her and win her.
I kept chewing the jerky, to get as much of it as I could into my belly before anyone could take it from me. Belatedly, I nodded at him. Let him believe whatever he wished if it meant he would give me food. He sighed as he gazed at the night.
I think we are in the realm of death. It is very different from what I expected. I feel cold and pain, but I hear music and see beauty. I do not know if I am punished or rewarded. I do not know why I am still with these people instead of judged by my ancestors.
He gave Dwalia a gloomy look.
These folk are darker than death. Perhaps that is why we are lodged here, halfway down death's throat.
I nodded again. I'd managed to tear a bit of the meat free and was chewing it to shreds. I had never so greatly anticipated swallowing anything. He twisted away from me and fumbled at his belt. When he turned back, a large gleaming knife was in his hand. I tried to scrabble back from him, but he caught my tied feet and pulled them to him. The knife was sharp. It slid through the twisted fabric, and suddenly my ankles were free. I kicked free of his grip. He reached toward me.
Now your wrists, he said. Trust or not?
That knife could take off a finger just as easily as cut my bonds. I stuffed the stick of meat into my mouth and gripped it with my teeth. I held out my wrists to him.
This is tight. It hurts?
Don't answer. I met his gaze silently.
Your wrists have swelled up around it.
He slid the blade carefully between my hands. It was cold.
Stop that! What are you doing?
Dwalia finally voiced her outrage. The Chalcedian barely spared her a glance. He took one of my hands to study his task and began sawing through the rag that bound them. Dwalia surprised me. She had been in the act of adding a stick to the fire. Instead, she took two steps and clouted the Chalcedian on the back of his head. He went down, the knife still clutched in his hand. I tore my hands free of the last shred of rag and shot to my feet. I ran two steps on my buzzing feet before she seized me by the back of my collar, choking me. Her first two clouts with the stick were on my right shoulder and right ribs. I twisted in her grasp, ignoring how it tightened the chokehold she had on me, and kicked her as hard as I could, hitting her shin and then her knee. She shrieked with pain, but did not let me go. Instead, she struck the side of my head with her stick of firewood. My crushed ear rang and I tasted blood, but the pain did not matter so much as the way my vision was shrinking. I spun away from her, but that allowed her to hit me on the other side of my head. Dimly, I knew she was shouting at the others to seize me. No one leapt to help her. Vindalaya was moaning,
"Don't! Don't! Don't!"
His voice going higher each time he said the word. It angered me that he would moan, but do nothing. I pushed my pain at him.
She hit me on the side of my head again, smashing my ear. My knees folded, and suddenly I was hanging by my collar. She was not strong enough to support my weight. She collapsed on top of me, and my shoulder exploded with pain. I felt a wave of emotion. It was like when Nettle and my father merged their minds, or when my father's mind was boiling with thoughts, and he had forgotten to hold them in.
"Don't hurt her. Don't hurt her."
Dwalia let go of my collar and made a strange sound as she rolled off me. I didn't try to move. I just breathed, pulling air back into my body. I'd lost the jerky. My mouth was full of blood. I turned my head and opened my lips to let it run out.
"Don't die. Please don't die and leave me alone."
Vindalaya's thought whispered to me. Oh, that was it. When I'd pushed my pain at him, I'd opened a way for his thoughts to come in. Dangerous. With every bit of willpower I could muster, I blocked him from my mind. Tears stung my eyes, tears of fury. Dwalia's calf was within reach of my teeth. I wondered if I could bite a piece of meat off her leg.
"Don't, cub. She still has the stick. Crawl away. Quietly. This is one you don't attack until you are sure you can kill her."
I tried to wriggle away, but my arm wouldn't obey me. It flopped uselessly. I was broken. I blinked at the pain and little black spots danced in front of my eyes. Dwalia got to her hands and knees and then stood up with a grunt and walked away without looking at me. When she reached the other side of the fire, she sat down on the pack again and resumed looking at her much-folded paper and the little scroll she had taken from the bone. Slowly she rotated the pieces of paper, then suddenly leaned closer to them. She set them side by side on her knees and looked from one to the other. The Chalcedian sat up slowly. He reached around to the back of his head, brought his hand before his eyes, and rubbed his wet fingertips together. He watched me sit up and shook his head at my flopping, useless arm. "It's broken," I whispered. I desperately wanted someone to care that I was hurt so badly.
"Darker than death," he said quietly.
He reached over and put his fingers on the point of my shoulder and prodded it. I yelped and flinched away.
"Not broken," he observed, "but I don't know your word for it."
He made a fist and clasped it in his other hand. Then he pulled his fist out.
"Popped out," he told me.
He reached toward me again, and I cowered away, but he only waved at my shoulder.
"Popped out."
"My arm won't move." Panic was rising in me. I couldn't get a breath.
"Lie down. Be still. Be loose. Sometimes it goes back in."
He looked over at Dwalia.
"She's a wasp," he observed.
I stared at him. He smiled sickly.
"A Chalcedian saying, if the bee stings, it dies. It pays a price to hurt you. A wasp can bite and bite and bite again. It pays nothing for the pain it brings."
He shrugged.
"So they bite. They know nothing else."
Dwalia suddenly shot to her feet.
"I know where we are now."
She looked back at the small scroll in her hands.
"The runes match. It makes no sense, but it must be so."
She stared into the distance. Then her eyes narrowed and her features changed as she realized something.
"He lied to us. He lied to me."
Dwalia roared. I had thought she was frightening when she was angry, but outraged was far worse.
"He lied to me. A market square," Prilkop claimed, "on a well-traveled road. He thought he was so clever. He tricked me into bringing us here. He tricked me."
This last she screamed, her face contorted into a stark mask.
"Prilkop!"
Spit flew out of her mouth.
"Always so condescending, so calmly superior, and beloved, so silent, and then babbling, babbling, babbling lies.
Well, I made him scream. I tore the truth out of both of them, didn't I?
Apparently not. Alaria breathed the words, looking at the space between her feet and the fire. I doubt anyone heard her besides me. But Repin's head twitched as if she had, and she tried to sit up straight. You thought you did. You thought you ripped the truth out of his flesh, but he was stronger than you, wasn't he? Cleverer. Prilcop tricked you into bringing us here, and here we are in the middle of the wilderness, starving, dying. Her voice cracked. Dwalia stared at Repin, her eyes flat. Then she crushed the yellow map between her hands, stood up, and thrust it into the pack she'd been sitting on. The little scroll she had found, she rolled up and slid back into the tube. She flourished it at Repin.
Not all of us, Repin, not all of us will die here.
Her smile widened with pride.
I've deciphered it. Prilcop lied to me. But the true path is not to be defied.
She dug deeper into the pack and pulled out a small pouch, unwound the ties that secured it, and withdrew a delicate glove. Wolffather growled within me. I stared, feeling ill and not knowing why. Dwalia worked the glove slowly and carefully onto her hand, settling each fingertip into place. She had used it before when she had dragged us through the skill pillar. She stood up.
Bring the packs and the captive. Follow me.
The captive. My new title flowed over me like greasy water. Dwalia did not look back to see if they were obeying. She carried only her superiority as she strode to one of the pillars and studied the markings on it. Where does it go? Alaria asked timidly.
That's not for you to worry about.
The Chalcedian had followed Dwalia. He was the only one who did. I shifted away from the fire. My hands were free, my feet untied. They tingled with dwindling numbness in contrast with the roaring pain in my shoulder. Could I stand and run? I pushed with my good hand braced on the ground and moved my aching body a bit closer to the darkness. If I could slowly edge into the darkness, I might be able to crawl away. Repin had staggered to her feet and was trying one-handed to pick up my coat from the ground. I don't know if I can carry a pack, she apologized. No one responded. Ignoring Dwalia's scowl, the Chalcedian stepped up beside her to regard the pillar. He reached out and traced the carved runes.
I know this one,
he said, and smiled oddly.
I knelt almost upon it and had nothing else to stare at. I was six. We kept a vigil for my grandfather's body in the chamber of toppled doors in the Duke of Chalced's stronghold. It was an honor for my grandfather's body to be exposed in such a place. The next day, they burned his body on a pyre near the harbor.
Dwalia snapped her stare back to him and smiled.
This was in Chalced, wasn't it?
He nodded.
It was half a day's ride from my family's holding there. The Duke's stronghold is said to be built on the site of an ancient battle. There were four pillars such as this one, all dragged down to the earth, sunken to be flush with the floor of the chamber. It is said to be good luck if you can break a chip from one to carry as a token. I tried, but the stone was as hard as iron.
Her smile broadened.
As I thought, we are still on the true path, my Lurix. I am certain of it, when such good fortune smiles upon us.
She tapped the little scroll tube against her palm.
Fate has delivered a map into my hands. It's oddly drawn, and the writing is foreign, but I have puzzled it out. I know where we are on this map, and now I know that this pillar can transport us to Chalced. Kerf will take us to his family's holding and introduce us as his friends. His family will give us supplies for our journey home."
She swung her stare to Vindalaya.
"Won't he, Vindalaya?"
Kerf looked astounded. Vindalaya, carrying one pack on his shoulders and dragging another, looked weary and uncertain. The firelight shifted on his features, making him first an adoring servant, and then a beaten dog.
"My family will do that?"
Kerf asked in wonder.
"You will speak for us,"
Dwalia assured him. I scooted myself a little farther away from the fire. I could barely stand the pain of my popped shoulder when I moved. I cradled my useless arm with my good one, wondering how bad the pain would be if I staggered to my feet and tried to run. "I can't lift my coat," Repin told no one at all.
"No."
Kerf shook his head.
"I cannot speak for you to my family. I cannot even speak for myself. They will want to know how I have survived and returned when so many of my comrades are missing. They will think I have fled battle and left my war brothers to die. They will despise me."
Dwalia fixed her smile in place, put her ungloved hand on his arm, and gave Vindalaya a sideways glance.
"I am sure your family